Let's now begin with a discussion on the Chinese Premier Hu Jintao's visit to Washington. I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute for Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Hume Wee Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Her books include How China Opened Its Doors, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you again.
It's good to talk to you again, too, Susan Shirk. And I take it you were at the state lunch, that was Barbara Streisand was there, right?
That's right. Actually,
she got the headline.
She
got the headline for saying that she'd worked in a Chinese restaurant.
That was a great line.
So obviously, there's a comparison with, particularly with the state dinner last night, the notion that it couldn't not have gone as badly as the trip with George W. Bush, where there was a sort of serial group of insults to the Chinese leader, whether they were intended or not. In China, apparently they were seen as intentional, playing the wrong national anthem, giving him a lunch instead of a state dinner, and the Falun Gong woman haranguing him from the press corps. This seems to have been a pretty successful summit. Obviously, I don't mean to lower the bar by that comparison, but how do you rate it?
Well, it was very smooth and effective, and certainly the lunch I attended and all of the ceremonial events must have disabused Hu Jintao and his colleagues of any notion that the United States is in decline. You know, there are a lot of misperceptions now in China, in the United States, and in other parts of the world that the U.S. is a declining power. And we really pulled this visit off in style, and the substance was pretty fair as well.
But the statistics indicate that the United States' economy is, what, three or four times greater?
Oh, yes. Of course, that's why I say this is a massive misperception on the part of anyone who thinks that China is already the most powerful country in the world. China's, even the size of China's economy, although it's number two now, is still about a quarter of the size of the American economy. And if you look on a per capita basis, it's about one-tenth of the U.S. living standard. So there's still a tremendous gap between China and the United States economically, militarily. It's not even close. And, you know, we have a lot going for us if we maintain our confidence and don't get too down on ourselves and also do the things we need to do domestically in order to maintain the vibrancy of the U.S. economy.
Given this exaggeration of China as this sort of unstoppable juggernaut that's an emerging military power that's out scouring the world for resources, that narrative, of course, is definitely out there. But you, in your book, Susan Shirk, China, Fragile Superpower, turned that inside out, rather, didn't you, by suggesting, no, the Chinese leaders, we may ascribe that kind of power to them, but they don't see things that way at all. They're looking over their shoulder, riding a tiger of domestic problems at home.
That's right. I feel that it's not China's strength that should concern us. It's more China's weakness, its internal weakness. Its leaders are intensely insecure, and they see domestic threats everywhere. They're very worried about a possible repeat of 1989, the Tiananmen crisis, when you had widespread demonstrations in more than 130 cities in China, the leadership split on how to manage those demonstrations, and only because the military followed orders and came in and forcibly put down the demonstrations did the People's Republic of China survive at that time. And then, of course, the Berlin Wall fell and communist governments in Soviet Union and Eastern Europe began to collapse. So the more China becomes a dynamic market economy and the more open a society it is, the more nervous China's leaders are. And that insecurity could get them into trouble internationally.
But in terms of internal dissent, there hasn't been anything since Tiananmen, and I think the Chinese leadership successfully diverted democratic aspirations amongst the young and the students in particular, and sort of transferred that into nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that on a daily basis there's not demonstrations throughout China. Mostly it would seem, though, about working conditions and the heavy hand of the Communist Party or the corruption of local officials.
Exactly right. So the number of demonstrations increases every year, but most of them are pretty small scale and localized. And the party leaders work very hard to keep them that way. And you're also right that nationalism has become a powerful force and one that, to a certain extent, has been encouraged by the party leadership. But at the same time, they now feel under pressures to kind of stay ahead of that nationalist emotion. And that means, especially now, in the last 18 months or so, we see a more assertive China, because since China recovered first from the global financial crisis, it has created this popular demand for a more assertive foreign policy.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who served in the Clinton administration as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, in charge of Chinese affairs, and she has a new book, Changing Media, Changing China. In terms of the speculation in the press, and I imagine amongst China watchers, over whether the Chinese military have gone rogue to some measure, that Jintao didn't know about the stealth fighter and all this stuff. I mean, what's your reading? He's on the military commission, so let me get right to it. Is there a civil military problem in China?
I'm afraid there may be. I see some evidence of that. And yesterday in Washington, I spoke to some folks, some American officials, who had been in that meeting last week when Defense Secretary Gates visited China. The Chinese Air Force tested a major new aircraft, a stealth bomber, the J-20, at the very moment that Gates was there. Secretary of Gates went into his meeting with Hu Jintao, and he very politely asked him, you know, how should he explain this to the media when he does his press conference, that this test was held at the time he was there? Was this aimed at the U.S., and how should he explain it? And apparently it was absolutely clear that President Hu didn't know about the test. Now, of course, the president doesn't know about every test flight of a new piece of equipment, but this test, there are reasons to believe that it had been done quite publicly, and certainly the Chinese public knew a lot about it. So it was a very embarrassing moment for President Hu, and I think it revealed to the people in the meeting that the timing was not coincidental, and it had been done by the military to send a message, not just to us, but perhaps to President Hu, that they were going to make their own decisions about how to handle their relations with the United States.
So would this be, Susan Shirk, similar to the way the Soviets operated, that the Soviet civilian leadership did control the military, but the military had enormous autonomy and kept a lot of stuff secret from the leadership?
Yes, I don't know if it's quite the same. My sense is that civilian control over the military was more institutionalized in the Soviet Union because there was a Ministry of Defense that had real authority over the military. In China, there is no real Ministry of Defense. It's a nice building where they entertain foreign guests. But the only civilian control over the military is through the Communist Party Central Military Commission, and President Hu and Vice President Xi Jinping are the only civilians who are on that military commission. And, you know, I don't really feel completely comfortable with that degree of civilian control over the military, although in the past it's important to note that the Chinese military has really been quite deferential to the civilian leadership and haven't tried to go out on their own to any significant extent. So this is something new and something that certainly bears watching.
But who controls the purse strings?
Not the National People's Congress. The budgets are separate. It's a separate budget. It's not really debated by anybody.
Hmm.
And I don't know if the Standing Committee of the Communist Party Politburo really discusses it or not.
So it's possible. I mean, I remember under Deng Xiaoping, he felt that the military spending was such a burden that he invited the military to get into businesses.
Well, that's true. Deng Xiaoping, of course, was not just a party leader and a founder of the revolution, but a military leader. You know, and that's true for the whole first generation of Chinese leadership. Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, all of these men had led military units in the revolution. So their relationship with the military was very different than the relationship of the current leadership. And current leaders, Jiang Zemin and now Hu Jintao, they don't really have any standing with the military. So it's, you know, it's a challenge, I think, to maintain effective civilian control over the military in China today.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Susan Shirk, Director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the author of Changing Media, Changing China. Now, my understanding is that one of the reasons why this stealth plane popped up so quickly, and it's obviously very similar to a U.S. Plane, and there were recent reports that the 60 Minutes did a piece on Chinese espionage, largely directed by the Chinese military, and we know a lot of activity in cyber warfare. There's reports that kind of worm was inserted into some very, very important Defense Department mainframes, and an awful lot of data was sucked out of the U.S. into China. And part of that report was somebody from counterintelligence saying that the Chinese have all of the designs of all of the most recent U.S. nuclear weapons, which, of course, means billions of dollars of American taxpayers' money in terms of R&D. So is that a factor in China's apparently sudden, if indeed this stealth fighter is up to, is anything comparable to what the U.S. has, that would...
I'm in no position to say what was bought, what was stolen, and what was developed indigenously. It's just impossible for people outside of government or even people in government probably to know for sure about that.
Given the apparent autonomy of the military in China and their separate budget and no clear civilian control, and obviously public opinion doesn't necessarily matter that much, but my understanding is from the average Chinese citizen, they are just completely preoccupied trying to make a living and trying to improve their lives. Right? It's not a militant country.
Well, I think that is an important point to make, that China does not want to engage in a military conflict or even a Cold War with the United States. It doesn't have an ideology that's trying to spread throughout the world. It doesn't have those same kinds of ambitions that the Soviet Union had. And we don't have the same kind of conflicts of interest with China that we had with the Soviet Union. And on the other hand, I think having a strong military is a point of national pride in China. And people basically support military spending. I keep trying to find out if there's a debate about guns versus butter, you know, military spending versus domestic needs. And it really hasn't, except for a few intellectuals, college professors, I think most people support the idea that as China becomes a more powerful country, it should have a strong military as well, not to use it, but as a point of national pride and to make sure that people don't push China around.
Well, in terms of reports about this new aircraft carrier, it turns out to be one that they purchased from the Ukrainians. So it doesn't sound like any great strides.
Well, that's true. It's very important for us not to overestimate China's military capabilities. I mean, 30 years ago, they started military modernization program, maybe 25 years ago, and it was a pretty ragtag peasant army with no modern equipment. And then they bought equipment from Russia and started developing their own programs. So they're more capable than they were then, but they still have a long way to go.
So, Susan Cho, what is your sense of how, in your previous book to your latest, let me talk about your latest book, because we dealt a little bit with the central theme of China's fragile superpower, and that is that the Chinese leadership are constantly afraid of troubles within, not ambitions without.
Right. Let's
talk a little bit about changing media, changing China, because one of the ways that you get a feeling about what's happening in China is through the internet, but you've kind of got to be careful navigating that, because I understand the Chinese military or somebody in the Chinese intelligence apparatus has hired thousands of people to vet everybody's emails for censorship purposes, and they also pay them 50 cents for planting stories or posting right. stuff, you know. And that's, I think it has its own nickname in Chinese.
The 50-cent army.
The 50-cent army, right. So how do we navigate through that to find out what the people are really thinking?
Well, that's a problem for us, and it's also a problem for the Chinese leadership. You know, the commercialization of the media, allowing newspapers, TV stations, internet news sites to compete for audiences, has really transformed the media and brought so much more information to the ordinary public in China. It used to be that in the Mao era that the leaders had quite a bit of knowledge, but the people, ordinary people, had no knowledge. They only had this propaganda. Now, with the more market-oriented media, they have a lot more information, and that information gap is narrowed. And, of course, the internet only amplifies the amount of information about what's going on abroad and in other parts of China that people have. But the censors, the propaganda officials, still try to control content, political content. Otherwise, all content is wide open except for things that are viewed as politically sensitive. And by censoring and paying people to post pro-government positions, it of course distorts the kind of feedback loop that leaders get about what people are actually thinking. So that reduces the value of the internet to them.
Well, as you know, obviously we all know that Google pulled out, but I think because they felt that they were being spied on, right?
Well, they felt that that they were being actively harassed by the authorities, and that the searches were so censored that it really didn't give people a fair sense of the range of information out there. So they pulled out. I mean, they were hounded out of China. One thing, when you read the WikiLeaks on this, you see that there really was a concerted campaign by the propaganda authorities to drive Google out of China, because the free flow of information is antithetical to what the Communist Party stands for. But on the other hand, there are groups within the Communist Party, especially economic officials, who value the more open information. They understand that a market economy requires that people have better information, and they also see that when people have more information, it improves governance, because once people know something, the government has to respond and try to solve the problem. And ultimately, that translates into more support for the government. So I'd say the guys at the top are kind of split between the control coalition that have a fixation on censorship and making sure that people don't use the media and internet to organize challenges to the Communist Party, and the more enlightened parts of the party, especially the economic officials, who value the improvements in governments that can be achieved through more information.
Well, just in closing, Susan Shek, clearly we were taken by surprise by Tiananmen and the extent to which there was this pro-democracy movement, and they built the facsimile of the Statue of Liberty. And so it's not inconceivable that there are undercurrents that we may not be aware of. And I'd just like to get a sense in closing of what the kind of intellectual class, if you will, is in China. I mean, obviously, the Soviet Union surviving Stalin, where the best and brightest were systematically purged and murdered, and we see how short Russia's romance was with democracy and its kind of impulse for a kind of thuggishness and information. They're heading back to where China is, if you will. China, of course, has had some of the craziest activities of Mao and the starvation from his modernizations and the insanity of the Red Guard purges, where intellectuals were targeted. So give me a sense in closing whether you think China is I assume it's less wounded than Russia is, and more hopeful, if you will.
Well, the pace of economic progress in China has been so rapid that most people feel that their lives are getting so much better that there isn't a lot of opposition, political opposition right now, I would say. In surveys, we find that the Chinese people are among the most optimistic in the world. So the intellectuals and many urban young people are frustrated with the level of corruption. Right now, it's a dangerous situation because there are many unemployed college graduates. And all around the world, this is a group of people that have been in opposition to their government. They have a lot of time on their hands, and their expectations were high, and now they've been dashed. That's a dangerous situation for China. But, you know, it's very hard to predict the future evolution of China. I don't dare predict because I've already been proven wrong, because I had expected the pace of political change to be faster than it's been. So we could have Communist Party rule for a long time, or there could be some flashpoint, some domestic crisis in which people feel that the government isn't protecting them, that it's hiding information from them that they need to protect themselves. You know, something could affect a large number of people at the same time, make a lot of people angry, and things could unravel very quickly. So it's very, very difficult to predict.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today on Background Briefing, Susan Shek.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Well, I did too. Thank you. Again, I was speaking with Susan Shek, who is the UC San Diego professor and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and the author of How China Opened the Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest book, Changing Media. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back talking with James Fellows, the award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has lived in Beijing for 3 years up until recently, wrote Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China, and he'll be joining us in a moment.